Good morning. First case for oral argument this morning is Bonnie and Paul Bertelson, appellants versus Allstate Insurance Company, defendant and appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Paul Barnett and Mr. Scott Hoy, attorneys from Sioux Falls. And I understand, Mr. Barnett, you'll do the 20-minute opening, and then Mr. Hoy, you'll do the 10-minute rebuttal. Okay, very well. And for the appellee, Allstate Insurance Company, we have Mr. Thomas Fritz and Ms. Catherine Sabers, attorneys from Rapid City. And I understand, Ms. Sabers, you'll be presenting this morning. Very well. Mr. Barnett, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel for Allstate. Paul Barnett, Scott Hoy here for the appellants, Bonnie and Paul Bertelson. The issue generally in this case is contract medical benefit insurer's duties for payment when you have an injury arising out of a situation that may be work comp, may not be work comp, but work comp is denied. This duty is controlled by a statute, SDCL 62-1-1.3. I'll probably just call it the statute after this because it's been cited 1,000 times. And that duty is clear, unambiguous, and beyond debate. And what is it? It's that the contract insurers, such as health insurance and auto insurance, which we have here with Allstate, just have to suck it up, get out the checkbook, and pay. That's it. We're not going to allow these insurance companies to be doing the finger-pointing game back and forth. And the statute controls that. Briefly, the facts here, and I'll be real brief because I know this case is not a stranger to this court. December 26, 2005, Bonnie is seriously injured in a car accident while driving an employer-provided vehicle to a work site. Sounds like a work comp case. Work comp claim is made. The carrier is AIG. AIG denies the claim on two occasions, really, sends the letter of denial to the Department of Labor, triggering the two-year statute of limitations, and triggering the duty of all the contract carriers to suck it up, get out the checkbooks, and start paying. Bonnie, seriously injured in the car accident, months and months in the hospital. She's got a colostomy bag. She's on a wound vacuum, about $400,000 in medical bills. She's off work a long time. Initially, and I should say, too, that another statute comes into play here a little bit is SDCL 62-438, which is the statute that allows injured employees to choose what route they want to go in a situation where you have a work comp potential and a civil contract and tort claims. That statute says it is the employee's choice. It's no one else's choice. No one gets to second guess it. The decision was made because they did not want to get into a fight with the work comp carrier and put into risk, put at peril, the continuity of payment of medical bills to pursue the contract and tort claims. All the contract carriers and tort carriers seemed to be on board. Hartford was the first. It had $30,000 of auto med pay. It obeyed the law. It sucked it up, got out the checkbook, and paid. Allstate was next in line under our law because it's the car. Allstate was Bonnie's personal carrier, so they're second in line. And initially, Allstate seemed to be on board and was going to pay, but as we know, they never did. And the health insurance of Veracare also sucked it up, got out the checkbook, and started paying. Important to keep in mind, health insurance, in this case it had it, and it always does, it's secondary to car insurance. If there was one carrier who could have put up a fight, it would have been Veracare by saying, well, we don't have to pay until Allstate pays. They never did it. They did the right thing, and they went ahead and paid. Hartford did the right thing. Allstate did not. As I said, this case is no stranger to this court. After we started the lawsuit against Allstate for not paying, they made a motion for summary judgment. Summer of 2008, the circuit court granted the Allstate motion for summary judgment, and I appealed it to this court. Judge Zinter wrote the Bertelsmann 1 decision, which was issued April 1, 2009. Most of the issues here today that we're going to talk about pertain to Bertelsmann 1 and what we feel is the circuit court's failure to follow the case during the trial. I would say a Supreme Court decision is not a smorgasbord. You don't get to choose which part you want to follow and which part you don't want to follow. In this case, the only part that was followed was we had a trial. That was basically it. There are four significant and pivotal legal conclusions contained in Bertelsmann 1 which were not followed. The first one is found at paragraph 17 and 22 of Bertelsmann 1, and I quote, "We conclude that Allstate breached its contractual / statutory duty of immediate payment under SDCL 6211.3. We presented that to the circuit court by a preliminary jury instruction, a final jury instruction number 5, and even in our verdict form. Offered it time over time again, refused, refused, refused. Number 2, this is paragraph 14 of Bertelsmann 1. Thus, I quote, thus, once Allstate learned that AIG had denied coverage, Allstate had a contractual / statutory duty to immediately pay its benefits and resolve workers' compensation coverage and subrogation issues at a later date. We put that conclusion of law in requested jury instructions number 2 and 3, offered, refused. Number 3 point of law, this was Allstate's duty was not fairly debatable. Quote, unlike those other cases, the fairly debatable ones, however, the language of SDCL 6211.3 is plain, unambiguous, and not susceptible to debate. That's paragraph 20. I offered that in requested jury instruction number 8, and it was not accepted. It was refused. The fourth and final major legal conclusion from Bertelsmann 1 that we offered and which was refused by the circuit court, Allstate, quote, Allstate's obligation was clear from the statutory language alone, and an interpretive decision from this court was not necessary for Allstate to have determined its duty to pay under its policy. That's paragraph 20 again. It's contained in requested jury instruction number 4, I believe. Number 4.
You know, let me ask you about that, though.
Yeah.
Those last three, you know, the clear import is that there's a duty to pay immediately, but that can't be taken totally in a vacuum. I mean, Allstate certainly had the ability to take some reasonable time to adjust the claim for reasons other than workers' compensation.
For compensability, checking medical bills, and things of that nature.
I mean, it seems to me that you were asking for an instruction that would have precluded them from having any time to even adjust the claim for reasons other than workers' compensation coverage.
Well, Your Honor.
And that issue was never raised in Bertelsmann 1.
Your Honor, after Bertelsmann 1, we served a request for admission. And it was admitted that by May 1, 2006, and this is why I gave them the extra time, because I know what you mean. I mean, you can't expect them to pay. They knew about the denial on February 9th. We don't expect a check on February 10th. We understand that.
Well, then why should the jury be given an instruction that they had to immediately pay if they had a reasonable amount of time to adjust the claim for other reasons?
Well, it's a question of what is immediate. And under this situation, they admitted that by May 1, 2006, they had all the paperwork, they had everything they needed to do the paperwork adjusting of the claim. And it's always been my position that it's after that date, whether it's one day or 2 days, certainly not 30 days, that's when the contract is broke. It's sometime in May. Certainly, you can't go further than 30 days on immediate. Maybe 1, 2, 10 days, I don't know.
What about Mr. Blake's conversations with either you or your firm? It seems there was some evidence suggesting that might have been a cause for delay.
Well, if you're talking about Mr. Blake's conversation, Justice, in 2006, we didn't know anything. I mean, I wasn't even in the country. But Mr. Blake didn't have any conversations with us until probably 2007 or something. Are you referring to conversations with Allstate?
Maybe it was with Allstate, yeah.
Okay. in that regard, June 13, 2006, Allstate, Mr. Tierney, excuse me for a moment, I'm a little dry. Mr. Tierney of Allstate wrote a letter asking for the information so he could call AIG and further investigate the work comp denial. Well, under any reasonable consideration, the time for payment is long after, is long before June 13. In addition to that, Your Honor, Allstate's file notes indicated and clearly established February 9, 2006. Tom Blake calls Allstate up, says the claim's denied, we're making a claim with you. Work comp's denied, we're going for the contract. That claims adjuster in Minneapolis for Allstate, he picked up that phone, he called AIG, and he confirmed the denial. He got her name, he got her phone number, he got the claim number, he got the specifics of the denial, and it's all in there. So that was taken care of. So when Mr. Tierney sends this letter in June 13 asking for the same information, actually he only asked for a name, he didn't even ask for the contact information. That was just part of the delay. And we know that because of that. And then Mr. Blake gave him that information, and then you have the situation where Mr. Tierney testified that after getting that information from Mr. Blake, which would be late June 2006, he picked up the phone, called Mr. Blake, and his testimony is Mr. Blake said, oh, don't worry, you just keep your money. I'll go after work comp now. And, of course, that's completely refuted. There's not a single record to document that. They couldn't come up with phone records.
But shouldn't the jury make that decision?
And we know that the jury did not believe Mr. Tierney, and here's why. Under the statutes, under the jury instructions as given, okay, because there is no jury instruction about immediate payment, if the jury believed Mr. Tierney's version, they would not have awarded us breach of contract. If you believe that happened, you couldn't find a breach of contract. And so we know that the jury believed Mr. Blake over Mr. Tierney on that, because we did win the breach of contract in the end. Or, you know, the jury found for us. Anything else, Justice? Okay. There's a comment about the sufficiency of our objections and stuff. And what I want to tell you on that is I went through this morning. I read the first 15, 20 pages of the jury instructions, looking at the discussion between Judge Sertzka and myself. We, time over and time again, the record is replete with the plaintiff asking and begging the circuit court to file Burleson 1, and without the court agreeing to do that. And I push that to the point that, the circuit court just finally said to me, you know, when I asked the circuit court, will you please instruct the jury that Allstate breached its duty, statutory and contractual duty of immediate payment, then he finally said to me, this is quote, I tell you what, as soon as the Supreme Court presides on this case, then the ruling that they made will stand. But as long as I'm presiding, and it's my rules, and so far I haven't ruled that anyone has breached anything. Okay, so let's get this Supreme Court business behind me. That statement was made. That happened. And that was not an out-of-context statement. The Supreme Court, that's the way he approached this at every point.
Must have just thought it was our opening offer.
I think that's what he thought.
Okay.
Yeah. He was not going to apply the law. If I was on this panel, I would be asking myself, how did we come to that chaos? That type of chaos that we have a circuit court judge flat out saying, I know what the law is, I know what the Supreme Court ruled, and I'm not gonna abide by it in the four corners of my courtroom. Mr. Barnett, you go to the Supreme Court before you get that done. I guess I'm here, huh? He also, of course, called the decision obiter dictum. That's at volume 5, page 15. I see my time's running out. I'm just going to go to this briefly. Basically, how we got to that chaos was that once Burleson 1 came out, there was an absolute attempt by Allstate to try to relitigate the fairly debatable issue, which had been resolved in our favor, that this was the duty to pay was not fairly debatable. And during some of the depositions of the Allstate people, we have comments from Allstate counsel that we agree with Judge Sirska. The Supreme Court's decision didn't have anything to do with 2006. The Supreme Court ruled that this was a case of first impression, implying fairly debatable. The whole point of this was to try to get a situation where they could relitigate fairly debatable by having their expert on the witness stand and looking at the jury and say, hey, jury, Judge Sirska here, he agreed with us. He gave us a summary judgment. And so it's fairly debatable. That argument of pitting the two courts against each other, of saying, look, there's a circuit court, there's a Supreme Court. Circuit court said Allstate did everything perfectly fine. That's how they characterize it. Supreme Court, well, you know, maybe they disagreed, some technicality probably. But it's obviously, it's fairly debatable if two courts disagree. That is a subterfuge, and it undermines the entire system. You know, if we had a split decision, if we had three justices saying the insurance company owes, and it was not a fairly debatable claim, and we had two justices saying, yeah, the insurance company owes, but it was fairly debatable. If we had that situation, you couldn't use the minority opinion to undermine the majority opinion. Well, they were doing that with the circuit court's erroneous summary judgment grant, which, by the way, that grant of summary judgment, the crux of it was really a technical issue that there was, Judge Sirska felt there was no private cause of action under the statute. He thought it was in the hands of the Division of Insurance, which if I had ever thought that was correct, I would have just called up the Division of Insurance and had them enforce it. So his ruling didn't really get into the behavior of Allstate.
Was there any discussion, or is there anything in the language of Allstate's final argument where they use the words fairly debatable?
Oh, I think so, yes. Your Honor, they were able, because we were forced to try breach of contract. We shouldn't have had to try it. The case should have started off with, the contract was breached. Tell us why you breached it, Allstate. Explain why you breached the contract. That didn't start that way. We started with Allstate being able to claim we didn't breach the contract, okay? So they were able to start it, you know, way deep in our end zone rather than where it should have started on the 50-yard line. And fight the issue of whether there even was a breach. So they were able to go even beyond what you're suggesting, Justice Center, and to say there was no breach of contract, despite the ruling from your hand that there was a breach of contract as a matter of law. So I would say that's even more egregious. You see, my time is running short. I might move ahead a little bit. We do feel that in this case, we did not have an even-handed approach here. We think it was crystal clear that we should have been able to start the case right from the get-go, that the contract had been breached, that there was a duty of immediate payment. I think had we been given those four instructions or things close to that, and particularly just being given the instruction that, jury, you are advised as a matter of law that the contract has been breached, and then you'll just assess damages. We would have been able to then establish the bad faith, so there's clearly prejudice here. As this court probably is aware, there was a motion to correct the record under 1021.10, excuse me, under a statute. And under 62, no, I don't have that right in front of me, I apologize. At any rate, Judge Sirska had issued his decision on that, and in that decision, his notes is October 21, 2010, he says, on April 21, 2009, the South Dakota Supreme Court reversed in Burleson versus Allstate, holding that the defendant breached its contract and violated SDCL 62.11.3. 7 months after the trial, we now have a recognition, we have an embrace of the Supreme Court's ruling. Why wasn't that the law that was applied during the trial? Had that been the law that was applied, we would have prevailed on the bad faith count.
Excuse me, Mr. Barnett, yeah. What was that in reference to?
know what you said, but how did that come up 7 months after the trial?
There was a motion regarding supplementing the record or correcting the record regarding the testimony of three witnesses from Allstate under SDCL 15-2656, okay?
Okay.
The motion is just sitting there. Let me talk to you real quick. Nothing is integral to this appeal from that motion. Dennis Miller's trial testimony is not cited at all. Mr. Furstenau, his trial testimony is only redundant. There's other people who testified to the same thing. And Connie Lovejoy's trial testimony was not allowed in. So it's not integral to the appeal. We ask with that, I see my time is running out, we ask that the court reverse the case and remand for a new trial, allowing punitive damages, no reference to the errant summary judgment ruling. Also ask for the $100,000 on count one, and that the court allow us the full disclosure of the discovery information and to strike the or vacate the protective order. I think my time is up, right?
It is. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Sabers, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I want to start a little unconventionally and address this allegation that came up over and over as Mr. Barnett was speaking with you about something about pitting the circuit court against the Supreme Court. I read this transcript from front to back yesterday after reading the rebuttal brief. There is not a mention of the circuit court decision anytime at the trial, closing argument. It did not come up at the trial. There was no reference, no inference, nothing. So when he says, I want a new trial with no reference to the errant circuit court decision, I don't know why he needs a new trial for that. He had that the first time. Indeed, it was an issue that we had cross motions in limine on for the trial. I'll admit that. But that was in part because plaintiffs sought to introduce into substantive evidence and examine witnesses based on the Supreme Court decision in this case. And we thought that was inappropriate. The law in bad faith is clear that we're supposed to judge insurance companies by the law that was available at the time, not subsequently. So we thought it inappropriate to use the Supreme Court decision as cross-examination with witnesses. However, there was no mention of that circuit court decision. So to argue that somehow the jury was seeing some pitting the Supreme Court against the circuit court, it just didn't happen.
Well, Ms. Saber, in reading the transcript, Judge Sirska didn't allow any testimony about the breach of the contract, or very, very little that the contract was breached. And he didn't allow any testimony about the contract until after he'd given the instruction.
I guess I might not be tracking with you. I mean, they testified that they put on evidence. I looked through the transcript at least five times. I saw an opening statement. Mr. Barnett said the status of the law didn't allow them to deny based on workers' compensation. Mr. Blake testified during his testimony that he believed my client not only breached the contract but violated the law. Mr. Dietz said in his opinion they shouldn't, when workers' compensation denies, this shouldn't that Allstate should pay. It was again argued in closing argument that my client violated the law and breached the contract. And key, and I think most importantly, is the fact the jury was specifically instructed from the language of the statute, 6211.3, and guess what? In the end, the jury got it. I mean, they found a breach of contract on a special interrogatory. This isn't a big shock that, I mean, they understood the name of the game. They had the statute. They looked over the statute, clearly. We presume that juries read and follow the instructions. And they concluded, based on the testimony, not only that there was a breach, but also that there was damages for that breach and awarded damages.
You even objected in closing argument when Mr. Barnett was discussing breach of contract. You objected, and the first time, just Judge Sirska sustained it.
The second time, a minute later, he didn't.
That's right. You were still objecting to that in closing argument after there'd been an instruction.
That's accurate. Partially because that dovetails into the idea of introducing statute into evidence. And that's mentioned in passing in Mr. Barnett's brief. In absolute passing, it's mentioned that the statute should have come in as affirmative evidence in his case in chief. Doesn't give any argument on it. So we didn't spend a whole lot of time responding. It's an evidentiary issue. It's under abuse of discretion standard, and there's law, which isn't cited in our brief because we argue that it was waived, but it says it's the trial judge's job to instruct the jury on the job. It's not a piece of evidence to be put before the court. I understand Mr. Barnett comes before you and says, they forced me to try a breach of contract case. The judge forced me to try a breach of contract case when I shouldn't have had to. I don't know what that means. There's a lot of instances in Mr. Barnett's brief where he makes a very strong, interesting, appealing, colorful assertion like that, but I don't know what it means.
Didn't we say in Bertelsen 1, though, didn't we remand it for damages?
Absolutely.
And so then why would he have to retry the breach of contract?
Well, because one of the elements of a breach of contract claim is damages. Absolutely.
Well, it's one of the elements, but that's all they would have needed to try then, isn't it?
That's true, but as Justice Sinner pointed out, the instructions that he proposed in that regard tended towards the overstatement. And I think what we have to keep sight of when we're talking about these jury instructions, Mr. Barnett speaks of them in isolation. I should have had this instruction. I wish I would have had this instruction. I wish it would have had this language. The important part about that is this court's made a very clear distinction when it comes to jury instructions. If you're talking about the inclusion or exclusion of one instruction, or the wording of one instruction, the standard is abuse of discretion. On the other hand, we have to look at all the instructions to see if they're a fair and accurate statement of law.
But you know the operative instruction. It looks to me as like it's instruction 26.
Correct.
And that one, there's nothing in that instruction that told the jury that they had an obligation to pay irrespective of any workers' comp.
And that was put in through testimony, Your Honor. I mean,
right, but there's no, the jury was never instructed that the jury should decide the case as a matter of law, that they had no basis to deny the claim based on other workers' comp coverage.
Well,
that instruction doesn't say that.
It does say that when workers' comp denies, which was clearly brought into the evidence at trial, that that an insurer has to pay. And that's what the statute says. And this court in Bertelsen 1 said this statute's plain and unambiguous. It's plain as the nose on your face. It shouldn't be subject to interpretation. I guess my point coming before you today is, indeed, that instruction was given. It was given more closely paralleling the statute than the one that Mr. Barnett proposed. He, in fact, proposed a different instruction on the statute where he wanted to stick a parenthetical in there and argued that it would be vague without the parenthetical. But he came to you before that and said, the statute's absolutely plain and unambiguous. And then he wants to go to the circuit court and say, without an explanatory parenthetical in the middle of it, it's vague. Those are two inconsistent positions. But perhaps the most important, the absolutely most important point in all of this is, we have special interrogatories in this case. The jury went to the jury with special interrogatories, and they got it. They read the evidence. They saw the evidence. They read the statute. They awarded damages for a breach of contract. They found a breach of contract. And what the court said is an issue of based on damage, or is an issue of fact, excuse me, on damages, and an issue of fact on bad faith. And the jury made that distinction from the evidence presented. You guys, or the court should recall that when this was here the first time, there wasn't one iota of deposition testimony before you. There was not an iota of testimony. No one had been deposed. All state's employees hadn't told their side of the story. Mr. Barnett argued from one letter, that June 13, 2006 letter, that Allstate made a promise with no intention of performing because Mr. Tierney said, give me the name of your work comp adjuster and I'll follow up. And that was it. That was the end of the record. On remand, the jury heard evidence that June 13th, 2006 was the letter. It was the first time Mr. Tierney had seen the denial letter from AIG, which said, because we haven't received any additional information, we're going to continue in our denial. Mr. Tierney testified, looked the jury in the eye, was there, and said, I picked the phone. I called Mr. Blake. I said, what additional information do you think they need? Should we try to get some additional information? And Blake gave him the impression he was going to follow up with Bert Kopp and get back to him. That was the impression Mr. Tierney left with.
Did Mr. Tierney do anything after that?
Well, he said, Mr. Tierney said, I was expecting a call back. That's what he told me. And Blake didn't call back for a year. It was Mr. Tierney's testimony that he was the one a year later that called back and said, hey, I'm transferring the file. What's the status of this?
It was so did you use that factual argument to argue that there was no breach in this case?
Well, I think it's information that was not available to the court the first time, and it is now. The point is, though...
So the answer is yes?
I think it went more to the issue of bad faith than it did breach of contract.
How did you argue it?
How is it argued in closing argument? Mainly that Mr. Blake's credibility needs to be considered in determining what the intent or the actions or giving an explanation for Allstate's actions in this case.
Were the experts allowed to testify as to the obligation of the adjuster to proceed with the claim?
Investigate the claim?
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Dietz is plaintiff's expert. He gave exhaustive testimony that there was a duty to investigate, that he didn't think that there was that the investigation was completed. They had every opportunity and took every opportunity in this case to paint our client as a horrible, horrible actor.
Were the experts allowed to testify as to the obligations of the insurance company when a work comp carrier denied under South Dakota law?
And volume 3 at line 22, Dietz testified, which is their expert, when work comp denies, MedPay is supposed to pay. And he also testified, volume 336, Allstate did not have a reasonable basis to pay this claim. They presented this testimony to the jury. The jury evaluated it, and I think it's very important to understand.
They didn't have a basis to pay?
I might have misspoke. I'm sorry. They had no reasonable basis not to pay, is what Dietz testified. But the jury rejected that, and you got to ask why the jury rejected that. And that goes back to this Tierney-Blake conversation that we were talking about, because what's going on in this year where there's no contact only came out on cross-examination. And that was the fact that April of 07, Mr. Blake and Ms. Bertelsen get a check to State Farm and Blake only. They had had a check, the same check before with Avera's name on it, but they didn't cash it for 10 months because...
All right, before we get to that...
Yes.
When the demand for the $100,000 payment on MedPay was presented... There were also bills presented, which I believe were, $270,000?
In the range, and I don't have the exact amount.
So it was over double, and how many of those bills were contested? Was it the neighborhood of $30,000 or so?
That was part of the argument they presented at trial.
Well, is that factual or not?
I know there was a letter. I know that this is a, I know there was a letter. I don't want to speak something that's not necessarily in the record, but I know there was a letter referenced where Allstate had, first of all, they get notice, they ask for a proof of loss, they send back a proof of loss. Sometime after that, they send some questions about some of the bills. Yes.
So at that point, Allstate had a letter from the work comp carrier that they were not paying, had been sent to the Department of Labor. There had been bills of over twice the amount of the damages, and they weren't contested, and they still didn't send a check, correct?
That's accurate. They had not been paid.
Okay.
But the testimony from Mr. Tierney was during this whole time, during the time frame, he's talking to Mr. Blake, and Mr. Blake saying, yeah, I think it's work comp. Let's look into this further. And the point that, the reason that's important, I don't mean to diverge again, but the reason that's important is we kind of understand why now. So as I was saying, they had the check with Avera's name on it. They held it for 10 months because they knew the health insurance was processing these bills, and they wanted to get the health insurance cuts before they paid Avera So they'd have more money left over.
How does that excuse your clients not paying?
Well, I'm getting there, Your Honor, if you can indulge me for a minute. I apologize. But what I'm trying to say is Mr. Barnett's coming back up here and saying implicitly, he doesn't do it explicitly, I'll give him that credit, saying, well, the jury really shouldn't have believed Tierney. I mean, they really should have believed Blake when it comes to bad faith, and so we should get a new trial. Well, what I'm trying to explain is, and perhaps not eloquently, is there was all the reason in the world for that jury to make the credibility determination it did.
But you know, that credibility determination went right back to the question of workers' comp coverage. That's the dispute between Blake and Tierney, and that's about workers' comp coverage. And they're not entitled to delay for that.
And the jury found that they weren't. The jury found they violated the statute or breached the contract. I'm not going to stand up here and say I know what the jury did exactly, because Mr. Barnett said he knew what the jury assessed about Tierney's credibility. I don't think we can do that. I don't think we can step behind the jury verdict. But the point of the matter is he wants to complain about the instructions. And that's what this goes back to. It all dovetails back into those instructions he requested, which, as you pointed out, were somewhat of an overstatement. He didn't then say, okay, let's take this much back and only say X. He wanted really strong overstatement instructions that made it look like there was absolutely no question but there should be an award by the jury for $100,000, which, in my opinion, contradicts the assessment in Bertelsen 1 that there was an issue of fact as to damages.
But isn't the court's duty to give a correct instruction on the law?
I think as we have to when we go back and read the instructions as a whole, I think the jury was instructed according to the law.
What instruction told the jury what we said in Bertelsen 1, that there was a breach of the contract?
Well, I think that when you look at Final Instruction 26, which is the language of a plain and unambiguous statute, as this court has declared, that the jury was clearly instructed that the contract was breached, they were instructed what the law was, and that the law states, when workers' compensation claim is denied, the claim is presumed to be non-work-related for other insurance purposes, and any other insurer covering bodily injury for the injured person shall pay benefits under the terms of the policy. And that's what the jury looked at. The jury said, you should have paid under the contract. We're going to assess damages for that breach. And they assess damages for that breach.
That gave the jury the power to decide whether the statute was breached, didn't it? That gave the jury the power.
And they did.
As opposed to the court saying that the contract was breached.
What I think this is leading towards is Mr. Barnett's argument that had this been given, the jury would have been more likely to find bad faith.
Yeah, but don't we look at if the instructions are wrong, that's reversible error.
I don't think the instructions are wrong, Your Honor, with all due respect. I think the question is whether read in full, they present an accurate statement of the law.
Well, it may be, but if we sent Bertelsen back one with an instruction that their breach of contract had already, that it was a breach of contract.
And breach of duty.
A breach of duty. And that the damages was the issue that to present to the jury, and the court doesn't do that, that's reversible, isn't it?
I think there has to be a showing of prejudice, and I don't think they can make a showing of prejudice in this case, Your Honor.
Well, if you give the wrong law, it's certainly prejudicial.
Well, I don't think the law in itself is incorrect.
Haven't we said that?
I don't think the law is incorrect in the instructions, though. I think that's where I'm diverging from that particular point.
So you don't subscribe to the law of the case, then?
I don't think that's entirely accurate. I think that the law of the case is SDCL 61.1.3 applies in this case.
Was it your contention that this was obiter dicta, or did the court adopt that view on its own?
I've never urged that argument, Your Honor. And in fact, I think that brings forth a very important point. There's a lot of colorful comments from the court that are brought forth in the record, and I do think it's important to understand and gather that none of those comments were made in front of the jury in this case. Not one has been pointed to that was made in front of the jury. The jury sat through 4 days of evidence. Once in a while, he brings up, sometimes he says, I was forced to try a breach of contract. Sometimes he said I was forced to present a skeleton version of my case. I don't know which one it is, but the jury heard 4 days of evidence on this. They heard evidence on the intent issue of bad faith. They were properly instructed on the intent issue of bad faith. We looked to support jury verdicts, and I think the jury was fully and fairly instructed on this.
Well, on instructions, there's one other instruction that we haven't talked about, and that was at the beginning of the case, there was a request for an instruction on a statement of the case, and that was never given and it was never settled. We have case law that says that in itself is reversible error.
I'm sorry, there was no...
The statement of the case, there was never a settled instruction on the statement of the case that was requested by Mr. Barnett.
Well, there's a 22 is, final instruction 22 is the nature of the case.
Preliminary instruction.
I'd have to look, Your Honor. I know that Mr. Barnett had some issues with the court's introduction of the case. He calls it an instruction. I don't think it's fairly characterized as an instruction.
He requested a preliminary instruction on that.
And I think we objected that it was not accurate because I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor.
All right, but there was never any written instruction that he could object to then.
A written instruction that he could object to. As far as the court's introduction or explanation, probably true. I think in the end it doesn't really make that much of a difference. The fact of the matter is the comments that are complained of was this is a breach of contract claim. Well, this court has said over and over again there's three elements to a breach of contract claim, and one of those is damages. That's what it was. The petition or the complaint still said breach of contract. I'm sorry. Do you want me to finish?
If you completed your answer. I'm trying to let you finish your answer without giving you another speech.
No. He complains about vexatious, but they were accurately instructed as to bad faith, so I don't think that matters. Thank you.
Thank you.
You snuck the speech in. Mr. Hoy, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm sure there's some questions. I got a quick story that put this case into some light for me. I was working with my father about 11 days ago on a medical case that was working in the office, and the question came up in that case about a Supreme Court case called Van Z. I know it was 315 NW second. I don't remember the pages. And that is a medical case my father was involved in on res ipsa loquitur that he retried. As I'm talking to him and realizing that he's in the defense seat on this, he said, one of the biggest problems I had when we tried that case is that Judge Huerman did not want to give that instruction. And I said to him, I said, well, Dad, what did you do? He said, we had this terrible argument. I made him do it. I said, you have to. I said, why did you do that? It wasn't really your obligation. He said, well, that's what we were instructed to do by the Supreme Court. We had to. And I just kind of sat back and just thought, wow, I've been so caught up in this case, in the issues, in the fight, and all this kind of stuff. And this case would have been just so much simpler if we could have just walked into a courtroom to try a case as we were simply instructed to do in the first place. The template was easy. There was a...
You know, following up on that, when did you know for sure that the judge was not going to... or was going to require the breach of damage to go... or the breach of contract to go to the jury? And not just damages. When did you actually know that?
Well, we knew at the pretrial that the judge... I think it was at the pretrial that was one of the first times that he brought up his disagreement.
But there were a lot of motions in limine that he did not rule on.
I don't know that he ruled on any of them, which made things very difficult for us. We ended up even putting on the evidence regarding her other settlements, which we didn't feel had any relevance, but we felt we had to because since he wouldn't rule in the motion in limine, we couldn't just leave that as fodder for cross-examination. And it really forced us to try a case very differently than we wanted to.
What about the issue of the disagreement of involving Mr. Blake and Mr. Tierney and what the phone conversation was or didn't exist? Mr. Blake said it didn't exist. Mr. Tierney said it did. Is that a question of fact that should have gone to the jury and affect the outcome of the case?
If we'd applied the law of the case, I think the answer is no. But I'd also like to point out as further factual evidence that we had all the electronic records in this file from Allstate because they keep a file that is a central one. So any adjuster who works on it, it goes to the file and you have notes. I think there were 6 different adjusters that worked on this file and all their notes were in one place. There's no phone record that was ever produced that Mr. Tierney called Mr. Blake in June. And there's nothing in the records about it. Mr. Tierney testified, hey, I just remember the conversation. And this is 3 years later.
Well, the point is, though, should a jury make a call on that? Is that a jury question? Is that a proper jury question in this case?
In March of 2010, no, because of the ruling of this court. It wasn't for the jury at that point to make a decision as to whether or not there was a breach of contract.
Okay, well, what about the point that's made by Ms. Sabers that your proposed instruction on immediate payment was a little bit of an overstatement?
Your Honor, the word immediate is, I understand the point with it, but if you also look at the evidence as we presented, even through our own experts, there is a reasonable time for adjusters to do an investigation and react. My recollection of our expert by Mr. Dietz is 30 days, unless there is some reason that there's an investigation.
I'm not talking about the evidence. I'm talking about the language proposed for a jury instruction. Is there anything that tempered that absolute immediate obligation proposal?
Was there a different instruction that we offered? No.
So is it an overstatement?
I don't think it is.
Because
it's not an overstatement because I think the word immediate goes to at a point when you understand that you owe the money, then you should pay it. And that is consistent with the evidence that we presented through our own experts. Okay. One other point about law of the case and that the jury, there's discussion that the jury never heard anything of the discussion about Bertelsen 1 and that the jury never understood the issues there and that, but it doesn't change the fact that the law of the case simply wasn't followed. I mean, we don't offer that because it's information the jury shouldn't hear. The jury shouldn't have heard any of this. They should have simply heard the evidence and received the instructions consistent with the law that came down from this court appropriately. Your Honor, one other thought to go with the instructions. I think the way that that the breach of contract went to this jury gave them the idea that this was unsettled until today. But it wasn't. The question of whether this contract had been breached was unsettled, and that this was simply an argument between Allstate and Bertelsmann that had never really been looked at.
What about the argument that you were not prejudiced by that?
We were absolutely prejudiced by that, because breach of contract and the amount of the breach and bad faith go hand in hand. And so the argument that, in essence, what they were saying, this was a case of first impression, and that wasn't true. So the jury was looking at both breach of contract and bad faith under the guise of thinking this is a case of first impression. And they never knew that there was a statute specifically, that the law was clear that Allstate had to pay. Had they had that, that would have been a very different thing.
What's your view of the way the case was tried as far as the breach is concerned? You know, breach requires breach of a duty and damages. Was the case primarily argued on the basis of no damages or no breach of duty? What was the defense from your perspective?
The defense from my perspective was that there was no breach.
Breach of duty or no damages?
And actually both. And then they were allowed to bring in and to talk to the jury about double and triple dipping by the plaintiff.
Was that the focus of the defense, or was the defense focused on there was no breach of duty, ladies and gentlemen? Is that what they were saying?
That is what they were saying. That is what their expert said.
Excuse me, to say is or is not what their expert said?
That is what their expert said. He said, looking at the case from afar, I don't see any breach of duty.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hoy. Your time has expired.
Thank you so much.
We will be in recess for 10 minutes.